Good morning. My name is Ram Keshavan. The work that is being presented in this paper is basically has been contributed to by 20 plus engineers, maybe even more, over the last 15 years, right? And the good news is most of them have their hair still intact. I mean, I'm the one who lost most of it. I had no idea that the SnapMirror paper is going to get a Test of Time award. So I was going to make a plug for Waffle, but hey, 25 years, and there are sort of interesting trends that have changed over these 25 years. You start from a single processor, 300 megahertz box, to 40 plus cores that we are shipping now, right? The hard drives of different speeds, going all the way up to SSDs, and you've seen the explosion in SSD sizes in the last 4 years. I mean, it's pretty crazy, right? You can fire up an instance of Waffle in ONTAP. That's our operating system, up in the cloud in Amazon, I'm told now in Azure as well. We ship boxes with SCM in them. And we started off with, I believe, 20 gigabyte sized file systems, and now we have hundreds of terabytes, right? And again, the 400 terabyte is just a theoretical sort of limit for qualification. It's the file system just scales, right? We started off with NFS, mostly for home directory style file sharing for work group deployments. SIFS was called SIFS back then. SMB was added a few years later, and then non-access was added. So you see the workload has changed, right? When you take NFS or SIFS, you're talking about file sharing, append style, small writes, maybe some sequential reads, not that many random reads, and so on. And you suddenly move to this world of LUNs where, of course, a LUN is just a file inside the Waffle file system, right? So you're talking large random writes, large sequential writes, reads, and so on, right? It's a very different workload with very different latency requirements. And then now you can deploy, your VMDKs and your VHDXs or over SIFS or NFS or, SMB or NFS or LUN access in a Waffle file system as well. So, and then you have dozens of, management features, right? You name it, you have it in Waffle, and various versions of it, right? So you have inline deduplication, you have post-process deduplication, all of them running. So if you take a single box, you can have up to 100 plus file systems being exported. Each file system is about 100 terabytes or so, potentially. And you could have up to 1,000 LUNs being exported out of a box, and you have all these protocols running on the same box, potentially, in the same file systems, with all these data management features running at the same time. So that's the complexity you're talking about, being able to handle that in a file system, right? So coming to the topic of the sort of the talk, which is free space metadata, right? So there are two fundamental reasons why a file system tracks metadata. One is to be able to allocate new blocks to new incoming operations. The other is to report usage, right, for the administrator to do interesting things with that number. And if you think of designs that you would build for tracking free space, you kind of have two dimensions to look at. One is, and I'm sort of representing the extremes of each of those dimensions. You can basically say all my data structures are in memory, and that means my file system comes up, I read a bunch of data, and then I compute something in memory, and I keep it up to date in memory. On the other extreme, I can say I have everything persistent, right? The metadata that I need to use to track free space. A kind of orthogonal dimension is I can do it extremely lazily. And what I mean by that is, let's say the file system dropped the last reference to a block. I can choose not to update that metadata. I just leave the metadata inaccurate. The metadata says the block is still used. And then periodically, I can scan the entire file system and say, let me reclaim the blocks that are actually free, much like FSCK would, right? You can go that extreme. Or you can go the other extreme and say, everything is up to date atomically, right? And every file system chooses their sweet spot, right, in this sort of dimension, these two dimensions. And that's a function of the workloads, the function of the configuration, the function of what kind of storage media they sort of use, right? And the key to all of this is consistent performance, right? So you want to make sure that all this, and I call it backend activity, but it's basically free space reclamation is one of them, but you could think of all these data management features that we talked about could also be running as backend activity, right? And all of that has to run in a consistent fashion, but not impact the most important thing happening on the box, which is your client operations, reads, writes, NFS, SIFS, your LUN traffic, right? That's sort of the key, right? Especially in a file system that's being deployed at this industrial scale, yeah? So as many of my fellow developers in the Valley will testify, we do actually ship designs and then under time pressure and then regret it later on when you have to go and clean up that design. And it's sort of interesting, right? Waffle I don't know if it's serendipitous or not, but there's some of the designs for Waffle have actually scaled really well, and some of them we had to fix. Of course, it was unithreaded, right? Single threaded, so we had to fix a bunch of that, right, over the years. That was hard work. But some of the stuff just is so elegant that it kind of works. And SnapMirror, for example, it still just works. And that's the sort of beauty of the file system that I hope the paper brings out. So very quickly, I think most people are familiar with what the layout looks like. It's just a tree of blocks. Right? Everything is a file, including metadata, which is kind of important, right? Log structured and copy on write, which means anytime I write a block, a new version of the block always goes to a new spot on disk. Right? You never rewrite anything in place except the super block, right? So how this works is that as operations come in and mutate the file system state, you have a whole bunch of dirty content in memory. Right? At some point, you say, I've got enough dirty content to start a transaction. You draw a circle around that entire dirty state in memory, and then you start a transaction. Right? We call that a consistency point or a CP, right, in Waffle jargon. And we're talking fairly large transactions now, because you want to really amortize the overhead for taking that transaction. Right? So usually that lasts about 2 to 5 seconds. Again, what we are trying to do is make sure that you can do that without impacting front-end operations. So you want to finish the CP in some useful time so that you don't run out of resources, because you're holding down memory. Those dirty buffers are holding down memory. You need to get them out, right? On the other hand, you don't want to burn so much CPU that your front-end operations are being impacted, right? So we have the whole CP has to be paced in some fashion, where if I'm running a little slow, I need to run it a little harder. But if the front-end operations are coming in very slowly, I can take my own sweet time. So this can take 30 seconds and nobody really cares, right? If there is not enough load on the system, right, ideally. So very quickly, right, so I think most people are familiar with this. You have a tree of blocks, and of course, the Waffle file system tree is much wider and much deeper, right? So I've just taken a simple tree. And the very first time you dirty a block, you have to write it to a new spot on disk. So I think everybody understands the implications of this. The parent has to be changed because the parent now points to a new spot on disk. So you choose E prime, and you choose, then you free E because you don't need E anymore, right? And similarly, you choose B prime, and you free B now. And then atomically, you write a new super block in place. And effectively, you have kept all the blocks from the old file system that haven't changed, and you've taken a bunch of new blocks that belong to this new file system, and you've atomically moved the entire thing over. And again, this is, hundreds of thousands of blocks, of transactions in that one CP, right? So if you imagine now that you have a gigabyte worth of, writes coming in per second to that file system, right? You have to now do two things. One is you need to find a gigabyte worth of new blocks to write them to. And you also have to process the gigabyte worth of blocks that you just freed in the vanilla case, right, which is the green blocks here, right? This paper is focused on the second topic. I mean, someday we'll publish a paper about the first topic as well. And it's kind of hard to believe, but we spend way more engineer cycles on the second topic than the first topic. And we've sort of figured out write allocation really well, which is kind of counterintuitive. You'd think write allocation is the bigger problem, but actually not for Waffle. Waffle just works so nicely that I can do very clever things with write allocation. The block-free part is the harder part that we've sort of worked on for several years. So it's kind of interesting. So when I think about those two dimensions now, right, so we talked about earlier, what Waffle does is it chooses to keep its metadata persistent, right? And I can't speak, maybe Steve can speak to why we chose to make it persistent, but that, it made sense now because when you talk about the file system sizes we're talking about, the metadata to capture the free space just can't fit in DRAM. Right? So if you want to be able to support 400 terabyte size file system, you can't actually keep the metadata in memory at all. Right? And the second sort of important thing is that we always keep the metadata up to date. Right? Now, when I say up to date, it's at the CP boundary. Right? So every CP, the metadata that it writes out is self-consistent with the rest of the file system tree. Right? And that's also kind of important, right? So if you look at a standard Waffle file system or a node that's running ONTAP, it's always busy, 24/7, right? There is no downtime. There are no days that you have less load. There is no time of the hour where you can actually catch up on stuff, right? So you have to do all this background activity on the fly while you're still supporting the load, right? So we basically chose to have a pay-as-you-go model to do all of this free space reclamation. We just can't choose to do it at some later time. Yeah? So that's kind of critical to all the designs that we built. Everything is we try and make it pay as you go. Yeah. So the metadata that we actually use, and that's kind of very useful for SnapMirror as well, we use a simple bitmap, right? So the ith bit represents the state of the ith block of the file system. And it's just another file in the file system, a special file, so we know which one it is. But you just have a sequence of bits laid out in that file, from in the leaves of that file, right? Because it's a tree of blocks. Now, obviously, if you're talking about hundreds of thousands of blocks participating in one single transaction, you have to flip a whole bunch of bits in the active map, right? And sorry, I forgot to mention that the file is called the active map, right? Now, if you imagine those blocks being completely random in the block number space, you're talking about completely random updates to this active map, which is expensive because you have to load the block that you need to update, flip a bit in it, and then you've got this dirty buffer, which means you have way more dirty buffers in the active map, which you need to now, which the CP now has to write out as part of that transaction to leave that file system consistent, right? The other sort of interesting problem is what we call long active map chains, and the paper sort of formally defines what it is. But very quickly, right, so remember the active map is also self-referential. So blocks in the active map are also tracked by the active map. So in this example, in the picture on the top, you see block A is just another block in the active map. The bit that corresponds to block A lives in block B. And the bit that corresponds to block B lives in block C, and so on, right? And this is important because the moment I come and flip a bit in block A, I have to write block A somewhere else, which means block A is free, which means I need to flip the bit in block B, which means block B is free now, and so on, right? So the CP that has to flip these bits has to pretty much walk the entire chain, and sequentially as well, right? Because only when you process one will you know where the next one is, and so on, right? So you can't easily parallelize this. You could prefetch some of this, but it's not easy to parallelize, right? So this is sort of important, right? Now, this never mattered back in the day. And the reason is because you take a 20 GB system, you need 10 active map blocks or 20 active map blocks to, you know, to represent all of it. Who really cares, right? You can dirty all 20 of them, right? It doesn't take that much time to do it. The moment you talk about a terabyte size file system or hundreds of terabytes, you're talking thousands and thousands of active map blocks. This doesn't work, right? So over a period of time, we sort of came up with different designs to handle this. And the paper sort of presents all of them, and I'll sort of just talk about the last technique, which is now effectively scales for infinitely sized, you know, volumes, right? It just works for anything. And the idea is sort of straightforward, right? What you do is, instead of freeing the block and flipping the bit in the active map, you simply say, I'm going to hold on to the block. And you hold on to the block by transferring the ownership to yet another block, yet another file, a special meta file, which happens to be a log file. So you can use the L1s of that file and simply append blocks that you've freed. And those appends are cheap because your, you know, sequential write is always kind of cheap, right? For every L1, you can pack in hundreds of thousands of blocks in there, right? Depending on the span of the L1, right? And eventually, so this is how you break the active map chain problem. And you can now use that same idea to say that instead of freeing the bits in the active map, I can just log it. And the idea is to collect enough of these, sort them, and then push them out. So now you have nice batched updates to the active map instead of random updates, right? That's straightforward, yeah? So we came up with, and here's where it's sort of interesting, right? We came up with the first design, which is called the tree log, which is sort of interesting. It's a very cute design, which engineers, of course, love. And in hindsight, that was a bad idea, but still. We embed a binary tree in the L1s of that file, right? And so as you can imagine, you can put blocks on the top of the tree, and they just sort of percolate down based on the sorting that you have. And eventually, when it comes out from the leaf of the binary tree, you actually get fairly good sorting, right? You get four active map blocks are being updated by all the blocks that come out of this, right? It worked really well, except when it didn't. And the problem was it only didn't work very rarely. And as you can imagine, if you imagine a binary tree and just so happens that for the right pattern of freeze, you end up getting one small subtree in that tree being full. And the very next insert is going to dirty a whole bunch of nodes in that binary tree, which effectively is a bunch of L1s of that log file. Right, so instead of freeing that block, I could have as well flipped the bit in the active map instead of inserting this one single block, which caused a whole bunch of dirty blocks that the CP had to process now. Right, so that's where, and the problem is this never happened easily. Right, once in a while we hit it like three times in-house, and before we could figure out what it was gone. And maybe three customers hit it, and the behavior is also weird. Right, so that one CP that's unlucky enough to see that will see a 30-second, you know, them. And the filer, the box would just sort of stall and then recover. And once it recovers, it's never going to happen again because you've just completely emptied out that section. And you'll never see that again. And probability-wise, it was just so hard to hit. And we kind of knew this could happen, theoretically. And we tried to do the math modeling to figure out how often it would happen. And we never sort of liked the answer. I mean, we never thought that it would happen that easily. But then the number of customers we have is so large that, you know, this becomes easier to hit. So we walked away from that kind of design and decided to do something else, which is called the batch free log. And now, you know, it's a very similar idea, except now we have three files. One is the append file. And once you fill it up, you move it, swap it out, and you sort in place, merge sort, and then swap it out again, and you push it out to the active map. Right? So now, the nice thing about this design is you can actually do that pay-as-you-go model, which means for every n appends, I can do m sorts and k freeze based on how expensive each of those activities are. Right? So now you have this nice, smooth, every time I insert in, I can just do the right amount of work, and this just works really well. Right? So this was a simpler idea, which we probably should have done first. We realized that 0.5% of the file system is all we need, right? For collectively for all these files together, right? Again, I've talked about overwrites, but you can imagine any kind of activity that causes free blocks can use the same technique. You don't have to flip bits in the active map; you can go flip. So debugging this is a kind of interesting. There are some interesting horror stories I can tell you about later. Quick results, right? So the one on the left is random overwrite, heavy random overwrites, right, on a box. And you can see with logging, obviously, you get significant improvement both for throughput as well as latencies, right? On the right, we have a different graph, which is a raw delete benchmark, where we take a 1 terabyte sized file, file data set, delete a whole bunch of files, and then we measure the rate at which those blocks are reclaimed by the file system, right? And we have two bars, the red and the blue. The red is aged data sets, which means we randomly overwrote the data set, which means the blocks that it points to, each file, are completely random in space. So obviously, you get more benefits with logging when you use that on an aged set. Again, this sort of undersells the performance here because these are all SSD boxes, so the I/O has completely been eliminated as a bottleneck here. It's just raw CPU. The moment you have a slightly I/O-limited system, that benefit shows up even in a bigger way, right? So this is the worst-case benefit that I'm showcasing here. All right, snapshots. You know, everybody kind of knows them. So the idea is you can take any particular CP and make that into a snapshot, right? And the way you do that is you take that red super block and stash it away somewhere. And then make sure that no other block in that, no block in that red tree ever gets reused or freed, right? And we sort of use a terminology like S0 to denote the current file system, which is the purple tree, which keeps moving away from the recent snapshot. So if you look at the red tree has an active map trapped in it. Remember, no block in the red tree can be freed, which means there's an active map in there which represents the free blocks in S1, right? And B prime and E prime are free in that active map. But in the purple tree, you have B prime and E prime used, but B and E have been freed. So each snapshot has its own active map that is accurate, yeah? Now, of course, there's terminology. We use the term volume to refer to the current file system and all the snapshots behind it, right? So if you want to figure out if a block is free, the only way to do that is by looking at the active map of every snapshot in the volume, including the current file system. And that's kind of expensive, right? So we actually have what is called a summary map, which is effectively a BitOr of the active maps of all the snapshots. And we keep that in the active file system, in the current file system. Now, and the block is obviously free only if the active map and the summary map say it's free. Now, obviously, you can see that the summary map can become stale instantaneously if you did a snapshot create or a snapshot delete and other such wonderful activities that Waffle lets you do, right? And so you can imagine that a scan can run, and the scan is fairly efficient because it's walking sequentially. You can prefetch a bunch of things. You can even do that in parallel because the paper kind of explains formally why it's safe to do things in parallel as well. These are idempotent scans. And the paper also explains what happens in that window while the scan is not yet done, but the summary is kind of stale. And it proves correctness, which sort of, you know, the paper sort of formally explains that. The key is that you're being able to reclaim that stuff in a fairly fast mode without impacting front-end operations, right? So the last picture I want to throw at you is the fact that Waffle actually has the concept of an aggregate, which is effectively the entire storage that you're talking about, several terabytes worth of it, and it hosts several flex walls in it. And what you have is each flex wall is the blocks in the flex wall are effectively just L0s or leaves of yet another file in the aggregate, right? So each flex wall has its own container file, and all you have is, so if you want to refer to the super block, it's just the first block in that container file, the first leaf of that container file, right? So as you can imagine, you have an active map in the aggregate, which is the raw physical blocks. You have an active map in each flex wall. Each flex wall can take snapshots. Each aggregate can take snapshots. And a block is really, so you can have a summary map in the aggregate, a summary map in the flex wall. And a block is really only free in the flex wall if both those maps say it's free. And then you come out and punch that block out in the container. And then you can free the active map. And so you have this nice pipeline. And that's why we spend so many engineering cycles to make sure that this pipeline can actually handle this, all this work. Yeah. So I'm going to jump right past and conclude. The key is consistent performance, right? All these designs don't matter unless you can actually prove that this can work at runtime without impacting client ops. And that's sort of the key for this design. Questions?
You kind of made an interesting point about finding this performance problem kind of more or less serendipitously because you had enough of customers who, but kind of it made an interesting point is that in a system like this where you have so many corner cases potentially and often a good design which is works very well for the 99 percentile doesn't really work for the 1%, and maybe it's 99.9 in your case. So, in your experience, how, both what approaches did you take and kind of did you have lessons to help other people in the community understand the trade-off between debugging such a thing for performance problems versus kind of analytical and kind of modeling through mathematics or even kind of just exercising a lot of random workload. So, what all did you try and how was the experience?
So, we've had a fantastic performance team in associated with ONTAP, right? And they actually do a whole bunch of testing for us for waffle testing as well as RAID and other subsystems in ONTAP. And so we lean on them quite heavily to sort of point out things to us which is not obvious to us. The testing aspect of the correctness issues, making sure the CPUs finish up on time, there's no easy answer there, right? So every time we come up with a design, it has to get validated by several engineers and we have to go through that process. There's no easy way to do it. Often enough, we find that, we find most of the cases in-house because we have sufficient QA coverage and sufficient benchmarks that catch it. And we have our own benchmarks which are different from the standard ones that you've seen in SpecFS and SPC1 and so on, because we need to actually catch some cases that some customers hit that are not really captured by, if you take EDA workloads, electronic design automation workloads, SpecFS doesn't do a good enough job of EDA workloads running on NFS, right? Because they do massive deletes and they do it in one go, right? So we have actual benchmarks that specifically test the worst case scenario in there. And we try and set it up in a way that we always hammer the worst case. And the hope is that if you caught the worst case, then the vanilla cases will work fine, because that's what we've been designed for mostly. Right? But again, every release we find things that we try and fix. And this is an ongoing thing. You'd have to come and catch me offline to sort of get some experiences out of my head.
How up to date is the free block map? So you're doing block allocation and file systems always run full. Is there a, and my head kind of exploded when we thought about aggregation maps and snapshots and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There's several layers of it. Is there a pipeline that traps blocks that are really free, but you're not quite sure they're free yet? Because you mentioned the background update of the summary map.
So we basically wait for a snapshot deletion to actually update the summary, right? So, and when that happens, the summary delete scan actually runs pretty fast. Right, we do pace it. We don't want it running so hard that it takes away I/O. But imagine the I/O is all sequential, right? So you can actually refresh those things fairly well. The CPU cost of flipping bits and bit math is not that high, and we have some clever algorithms to make that really fast. So we actually trust the system to manage to push blocks out. And at every point, we kind of bunch updates so that if there are places where I've got a whole bunch of random frees, I'll just wait for them to collect up to a point and then push it out further.
Okay.
So there are places in the pipeline where we don't actually push it out right away. We just hold on to it for a little bit.
Right, and do you have like a budget or that?
Oh, yes.
For how much space that can...
So historically, we've had 10% because I think it came from FFS. And we kind of have changed it for some deployments because there are deployments where people don't do random writes. So they keep their data set around forever. They just write it once and then keep it around forever. And you don't really need that 10% reserve at all, not even close to that, right? And Waffle will work really fine. And that's true inside the flex wall as well as in the aggregate. We keep that 10%. The virtual numbers that you have inside the flex wall also has a 10% budget to it, right? And that's just a theoretical number, so it doesn't really matter.
Do you track inactive logs in memory or it's on disk or drive?
So everything is on disk, and anytime we want anything in memory, we pretty much load the meta files blocks that we need.
So does the cost of the merge becomes a limiting factor at any point of time?
So merging the in-memory, so the in-memory structure is literally the buffer that is on disk, right? So we don't ever merge it. Remember, it's literally that buffer that we load, and we operate on it directly. And then at the time when it's dirty, it just goes back as another version of that block.
Good.
Yeah? Most of these data structures, at least. Thank you.